America has always been more comfortable talking about ideals than talking about power, freedom, opportunity, equality. Those words are familiar, rehearsed, and widely accepted. What is discussed far less openly is who those ideals were built around, who benefited most from them, and what happens when the group that once sat comfortably at the center begins to feel that position shifting. For most of the country's history, America was not just a nation with a white majority. It was a nation designed around white dominance. That dominance did not need to be stated constantly, because it was reflected everywhere in law, culture, housing, education, employment, and political power. When power is stable, it fades into the background. It feels normal. It feels deserved. It feels permanent. As long as demographic dominance feels permanent, it does not register as power at all. It registers as order. The anxiety we are seeing now does not begin with immigration policy or public assistance charts or budget projections. It begins with a feeling that something once assumed is no longer guaranteed. A sense that the future will not look like the past. A realization, sometimes quiet and sometimes explosive, that numerical dominance is fading, and with it, the psychological security that dominance provided, even when it went unnamed. This is not about people suddenly becoming racist. It is about people realizing, often for the first time, that the position they occupied was not neutral. It was conditional on numbers, influence, and control. Demographic change has a way of making invisible power visible. For decades, America told a consistent story about itself. It was a nation of opportunity. Anyone willing to work hard could succeed. Anyone willing to follow the rules could belong. That story was not entirely false. Many people did find opportunity here. Many lives were improved. Many barriers were broken. But the story simplified something far more complex. Opportunity was never evenly distributed. It was filtered through race, class, geography, and timing. It was real, but it was conditional. That distinction matters because over time, the story stopped sounding like a description and started sounding like a promise. Inside the country, that promise was absorbed differently, depending on who you were. For white Americans, especially those whose families had been here for generations, the promise felt less like an opportunity to be earned and more like a baseline expectation. Stability was assumed. Belonging was unquestioned. The future felt familiar, even when it was difficult. Outside the country, the promise traveled even farther. America became not just a place, but an idea, a destination, a solution. The story suggested that effort would be rewarded, that systems worked, and that fairness was baked into the structure. That idea spread globally, reinforced by media, politics, and economic power, often without the caveats that shaped reality on the ground. What rarely traveled with the story were the limits. No nation has infinite capacity. Housing is finite. Jobs are finite. Schools, hospitals, transportation systems, and local governments are finite. These systems can expand, but they do not expand automatically, and they do not expand evenly. Expansion requires planning, investment, coordination, and honest conversations about trade-offs. Those conversations are difficult. They force people to admit limits. They force leaders to make choices. They force societies to acknowledge that growth has costs. America did not do that work clearly or consistently. Instead, it expanded its language faster than it expanded its systems. That gap became structural. For immigrants, this gap shows up as delay, uncertainty, and conditional belonging. Opportunity exists, but it is harder, slower, and more fragile than advertised. Legal processes stretch on for years. Stability arrives late, if at all. Progress is possible, but rarely straightforward. For citizens, the gap shows up differently. Wages feel stagnant. Housing feels unreachable. Schools feel strained. Healthcare feels unstable. People hear promises about growth and inclusion, but do not feel corresponding improvements in their own lives. When systems feel stressed and explanations feel abstract, frustration builds. This is where resentment begins, not necessarily toward immigrants themselves, but toward a system that feels like it keeps making promises without delivering results. The mistake comes when that frustration looks for a target. Rather than confronting the gap between promise and capacity, the conversation shifts toward blame. Immigration becomes the symbol. Demographics become the threat. Change becomes something being done to people rather than something happening around them. The discomfort of transition gets translated into a desire to restore a familiar order, even if that order never truly existed in the way it is remembered. What makes this moment especially volatile is that demographic change touches identity as much as economics. Numbers matter. Representation matters. Political power follows population. When a group realizes it will no longer be the unquestioned majority, it often interprets that shift as loss, even if rights remain intact. Equality can feel like erosion when dominance has gone unnamed. This helps explain why economic arguments around immigration often feel unconvincing on their own. Data about labor shortages or tax contributions does not address the underlying fear. The fear is not primarily about money. It is about control, about cultural continuity, about who the country belongs to, and who gets to define it. That fear does not require explicit hatred to function. It only requires uncertainty. Politicians respond to uncertainty with simplification. They talk about borders, numbers, restrictions, and enforcement because those concepts feel concrete. They suggest control. They reassure people that something is being done. Economic framing becomes a safe cover for deeper anxieties that are harder to name publicly. This is why immigration debates keep resurfacing in different forms, even when the underlying conditions remain unchanged. It is why restrictions return during moments of demographic transition. It is why public assistance becomes a talking point, even when the data is mixed or misread. These arguments are not really about budgets. They are about boundaries. The irony is that demographic change itself is not new. America has gone through multiple waves of transition. What is different now is the speed, visibility, and global context in which it is happening. Information travels faster. Images circulate instantly. Population shifts are easier to track and harder to ignore. What once unfolded quietly over generations now feels immediate. When people feel overwhelmed, they reach for certainty. When certainty is unavailable, they reach for nostalgia. This is the emotional landscape in which modern immigration policy operates. Not in isolation, not as a standalone issue, but as a pressure point where unresolved questions about power, identity, and transition surface again and again. Understanding that landscape matters, because without it, policy debates stay shallow. They revolve around numbers without addressing fear. They argue economics without acknowledging identity. They promise fixes without naming limits. The story that follows is not about a single administration or a single law. It is about how a country built around demographic dominance responds when that dominance begins to shift. To understand why restrictions resurface, why panic cycles repeat, and why conversations feel stuck, we have to go back to when demographic control was explicit, when it was written into law, and when it was openly defended as national interest. That history begins long before modern headlines. It begins in the early 20th century, when America decided clearly and deliberately who it was willing to become and who it was not. Let's talk about the 1920s through the 1940s, because this breakdown matters. The current White House move to restrict roughly 75 countries is being explained through economic language, public assistance risk, and system strain. And while that framing sounds modern and neutral, it follows a pattern that has been used before under different names. Policies like this do not appear suddenly. They reemerge when older anxieties resurface. And to understand why they take the shape they do, it helps to look at how immigration policy was originally constructed and what it was designed to protect. By the early 20th century, the United States had already begun to experience unease about who was arriving and how those arrivals were changing the country. Immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe had increased significantly, bringing in populations that differed from the Northern and Western European Protestant groups that had long held cultural, political, and economic dominance. This shift did not simply raise questions about labor or infrastructure. It challenged assumptions about identity, belonging, and who counted as fully American. The response that followed was intentional rather than reactive. When Congress passed the Immigration Act of 1924, it did so with the explicit goal of preserving the existing demographic makeup of the country. The law established national origins quotas based on census data from decades earlier, effectively locking the population into a past version of itself and sharply limiting entry from regions associated with newer immigrant groups. This approach was framed at the time as responsible governance, a way to protect social stability and national character in an era of rapid change. That logic reflected widely accepted beliefs of the period. Ideas about racial hierarchy and population management were not confined to the political margins. Eugenics was treated as legitimate science. Policymakers, academics, and public figures openly discussed the idea that nations could decline if they failed to manage who entered and reproduced within their borders. Immigration policy became one of the tools used to carry that belief into law, embedding preferences and exclusions into the structure of the system rather than relying on informal discrimination alone. As a result, immigration law during this period did more than regulate numbers. It established priorities and distinctions that aligned with prevailing views about race and cultural fitness. Northern and Western Europeans were favored, Southern and Eastern Europeans were restricted, and immigration from Asia and much of Africa was effectively blocked. These outcomes were not incidental. They reflected a broader effort to shape the population in ways lawmakers believed would preserve American identity as they understood it. This framework did not exist in isolation. American racial policy, including its immigration laws, was observed and studied internationally. In Germany, legal scholars and political thinkers examined U.S. approaches to citizenship, segregation, and population control as examples of how a modern state could formalize racial hierarchy through law. While the United States did not pursue the same methods or outcomes as Nazi Germany, the underlying belief that population composition could be managed for national preservation was not foreign to American governance at the time. This context helps explain why the United States did not immediately position itself as a moral opponent to fascism in the 1930s. The discomfort with fascist ideology emerged gradually and unevenly, shaped as much by geopolitical threat as by ethical rejection. The decisive break came through war and aggression, rather than through an early repudiation of racial ordering as a governing principle. Before that break, America was largely comfortable with being a white nation by design. That design was reinforced not only through immigration law, but through housing policy, labor markets, and citizenship rules that favored whiteness as both a social and legal advantage. These structures operated together to maintain demographic dominance without needing constant justification. World War II disrupted this equilibrium. The exposure of Nazi atrocities made explicit racial hierarchy untenable as a public foundation for democratic leadership. As the United States moved into a position of global influence, it became necessary to revise how it talked about itself and how its laws aligned with its stated values. This shift did not happen all at once, and it did not involve a complete abandonment of population management as a concept. Instead, it involved a change in language and justification. Race could no longer be named directly, so other criteria took its place. Economic contribution, legality, security, and administrative capacity became the acceptable terms through which immigration could be debated. These categories appeared neutral and pragmatic, even as they often produced outcomes similar to earlier exclusions. The system no longer declared who it preferred in explicit racial terms, but it continued to sort and filter through mechanisms that shaped demographic outcomes over time. This is where the connection to the present becomes clearer. When modern policies emphasize public assistance risk or system strain, they operate within a framework that was built to manage population change without openly discussing its underlying motivations. The concerns being raised may be real, but they are rarely separated from the historical patterns that gave them shape. Restrictions tend to fall along familiar lines, not because of coincidence, but because the structure guiding them has deep roots. The original design of American immigration policy shows that the country once spoke plainly about demographic preservation as a national goal. That clarity is uncomfortable now, so it is avoided. Yet the anxiety it addressed has not disappeared. It reemerges when demographic dominance feels uncertain, when cultural continuity feels threatened, and when political power appears to be shifting in ways that cannot easily be reversed. Understanding this does not require endorsing past exclusions or dismissing present concerns. It requires recognizing that today's policy debates are not purely technical. They carry the weight of a history in which immigration law was used to shape the nation's identity as much as its labor force. Without acknowledging that lineage, current restrictions risk being misread as isolated responses rather than as part of a longer cycle of adjustment. That thought process and cycle continued after the war. The country changed its rules without fully confronting the logic behind them. So America moved forward with the revised language and expanded commitments without fully understanding or projecting the demographic consequences that would follow. That is the transition that comes next. The period after World War II forced the United States to rethink how it presented itself to the world, but it did not force a full reconsideration of how power functioned inside the country. The war created a moral break in public language, not a structural break in how demographic control was understood. That distinction matters because it explains why so many changes that followed felt transformative while still carrying older assumptions beneath the surface. Coming out of the war, the United States emerged with unprecedented global influence. It positioned itself as a defender of democracy, freedom, and human rights, in direct contrast to authoritarian systems. That role required credibility. Explicit racial hierarchy could no longer sit comfortably alongside claims of moral leadership, especially as the country sought allies across Asia, Africa, and the developing world during the Cold War. The language of race became a liability in international politics, even as the realities of power at home remained uneven. This pressure reshaped how the country talked about itself. Civil rights reforms began to challenge legalized segregation and discrimination, not only because injustice had become impossible to ignore domestically, but because racial exclusion undermined America's global standing. Immigration policy entered this shift more quietly, but it was part of the same recalibration. Laws that openly favored certain races or regions became increasingly difficult to defend in a world where the United States was competing for influence beyond Europe. The response was not to abandon control, but to change the terms through which control was exercised. Race was removed from the language of law, replaced with criteria that appeared neutral and universal. Fairness, family unity, and skills became the dominant frames. This allowed the country to align its policies with its moral messaging without directly confronting how those policies would reshape population dynamics over time. This is where the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965 enters the picture, and while its mechanics have already been broken down elsewhere, its role in this sequence is essential. The law eliminated national origins quotas and replaced them with a system centered largely on family reunification, along with smaller employment-based categories. At the time, the emphasis was on correcting discrimination rather than transforming the future composition of the country. Lawmakers repeatedly downplayed the scale of change. The reform was presented as a moral correction that would not dramatically alter immigration levels or demographics. That belief rested on a misunderstanding of how systems behave over time. Family-based immigration does not operate as a one-time admission. It functions as a multiplier. Each legal entry creates the possibility of future entries, spaced out over years and decades, all operating within the bounds of the law. What changed was not the idea that the country could manage who entered, but the mechanism through which that management occurred. The system no longer selected explicitly by race. It selected by relationship and eligibility, while global inequality and population growth ensured that demand would come from regions previously excluded. The demographic consequences followed naturally, even if they were not fully anticipated. At the same time, the country did not adjust its capacity or its language to match this new reality. Infrastructure, housing, education, and local governance continued to be planned as if demographic change would remain modest and predictable. The national story emphasized opportunity and openness, but rarely discussed scale, limits, or long-term integration planning. Moral expansion moved faster than institutional preparation. This disconnect was not immediately visible. Economic growth in the post-war decades masked strain. Labor demand absorbed new workers. Communities adjusted gradually. The system appeared to function, reinforcing the belief that expansion could continue without friction. Over time, pressures accumulated unevenly, concentrated in certain regions, industries, and public services. What never happened during this period was a direct conversation about power. The country did not openly grapple with what it meant to move from a white majority nation by design to a more pluralistic society in practice. The rules changed, but the underlying assumption that the dominant group would remain central went largely unexamined. Demographic change was treated as abstract, distant, or temporary, rather than as a structural shift with political and cultural consequences. This matters because when power transitions are not acknowledged openly, they tend to resurface as anxiety later on. The absence of an honest reckoning created space for confusion. People were told the country stood for equality and opportunity, but were not prepared for how those commitments would reshape representation, influence, and identity over generations. When change became visible, it felt sudden, even though it had been unfolding legally for decades. By removing racial language without addressing demographic reality, the post-war reforms created a system that was morally expanded, but psychologically unresolved. The country spoke as if it had moved beyond questions of dominance, even as those questions continued to operate beneath the surface. When strain emerged, there was no shared framework for understanding it honestly. This is why later debates about immigration so often feel disconnected from history. The policies are treated as isolated decisions rather than as part of a long arc that began with explicit exclusion, shifted to neutral language, and produced outcomes that were never fully discussed at the time. The anxiety people feel now is not simply about newcomers. It is about a transition that was set in motion without a shared understanding of where it would lead. For many white Americans, the experience of the current moment does not register as hatred or hostility toward others, even when it later expresses itself that way politically. It registers first as disorientation, the sense that the country no longer feels familiar in the way it once did, that assumptions which used to go unquestioned now feel unstable, and that outcomes no longer align with effort or expectation. This feeling often emerges before any clear political position forms, which is why it can be difficult to talk about honestly. What is being experienced is not the loss of rights. Legal protections remain intact. Voting rights remain. Access to institutions remains. What is shifting is numerical dominance and the psychological security that comes with it. For generations, whiteness functioned as an unspoken default in American public life. Representation in politics, media, education, and leadership largely reflected that reality, reinforcing the sense that the system was built with familiar reference points in mind. When that reference point begins to change, it can feel like something is being taken away, even when nothing tangible has been removed. Equality can feel like erosion when dominance was never consciously acknowledged. The discomfort comes not from exclusion, but from adjustment. This is where the language of replacement begins to surface, not always explicitly, but as an underlying fear that influence will diminish over time. The concern is rarely framed as a desire for exclusion. It is framed as fairness, balance, or preservation. People speak about losing their country, losing their culture, or losing control, often without being able to articulate exactly what those losses mean in practical terms. Political power amplifies this anxiety. Population shifts eventually translate into electoral influence, representation, and policy priorities. Even before those shifts fully materialize, the anticipation of change can feel threatening. The sense that the future will not center familiar values or voices creates urgency, especially in communities that once felt culturally secure, even when economically strained. This urgency helps explain why restriction feels appealing. Limiting immigration offers a visible action that suggests control is being reasserted. It promises to slow change without requiring a broader reckoning with demographic reality. When framed through economics or public assistance, restriction becomes socially acceptable language for deeper concerns that are harder to express openly. Economic explanations play an important role here. They provide a neutral vocabulary through which grievance can be voiced without explicitly naming identity. People can argue about budgets, resources, and strain without admitting fear of demographic decline. This framing allows discomfort to be translated into policy preference without confronting its emotional origin. At the same time, economic insecurity is real. Housing costs have risen, wages have stagnated, healthcare remains unstable. These pressures cut across race and class, but they are often experienced more sharply when expectations of stability have already been disrupted. When people feel squeezed, they look for explanations that make sense of the pressure, and immigration becomes a convenient focal point. What is often overlooked is that these economic stresses are not caused by demographic change alone. They are the result of policy decisions, market dynamics, and structural shifts that predate recent immigration debates. However, when institutions fail to address those root causes clearly, frustration looks for a more visible target. This is how grievance becomes framed as fairness. Calls for restriction are presented as reasonable attempts to protect limited resources rather than as expressions of fear. The language emphasizes order, legality, and sustainability, even when the underlying concern is about maintaining cultural centrality. This framing allows people to see themselves as defending balance rather than resisting change. It is important to note that this experience crosses class lines. Anxiety about demographic transition is not limited to economic elites or to those facing direct competition. It appears in rural and suburban communities, among working class families and professionals alike. The common thread is not income, but the sense that the future will be shaped by forces beyond their influence. When political leaders echo these concerns, they provide validation. When they promise restoration or control, they offer reassurance. Whether those promises can deliver meaningful outcomes is often secondary to the emotional relief they provide. Feeling heard becomes more important than feeling resolved. This dynamic helps explain why policies aimed at restriction generate strong support, even when their practical effects are limited. The policy itself is less important than what it symbolizes. It signals that the system recognizes the anxiety and is willing to act on it, even if the action does not address the underlying causes. What emerges from this is not a population driven by hostility, but a population struggling to process transition without a shared language for doing so. Without honest conversation about demographic change, power shifts and institutional limits, discomfort hardens into grievance. That grievance then shapes policy preferences in ways that feel rational to those experiencing them, even when they misidentify the source of the strain. For immigrants entering the United States during this period of transition, the experience is shaped by many of the same structural forces, but it is felt from a different position. They arrive within a system that still speaks in the language of opportunity, yet operates under constraints that are rarely explained clearly. The result is not a simple story of success or failure, but a prolonged state of uncertainty that defines how belonging is experienced. Many immigrants come with the belief that effort will be met with stability, that following the rules will eventually lead to security, and that time invested will produce predictable outcomes. That belief is not irrational. It is reinforced by decades of cultural messaging and by the real successes of earlier generations. What is often missing from that narrative is how conditional progress has become and how unevenly the system now responds to participation. Legal pathways are central to this experience. Family-based immigration, employment visas, asylum claims, and temporary protections all involve long timelines and shifting requirements. Status that was once expected to resolve in a few years can stretch into a decade or more. During that time, people work, pay taxes, raise children, and build community ties while remaining legally vulnerable. Belonging is partial, security is provisional. This prolonged limbo shapes behavior. long-term planning becomes difficult. Investment in education, home ownership, or entrepreneurship is often delayed because legal outcomes remain uncertain. Even routine decisions carry risk when status can be affected by policy changes beyond individual control. Stability exists, but it is fragile, and that fragility becomes part of daily life. At the same time, immigrants are deeply embedded in the labor market. Many industries rely on immigrant labor to function, particularly in agriculture, construction, healthcare support, food service, and logistics. Work is available because it is needed. Yet social acceptance often lags behind economic reliance. Contribution does not always translate into recognition or protection, reinforcing the sense that participation and belonging operate on separate tracks. Economic pressures compound this experience. Rising housing costs, healthcare instability, and wage stagnation affect immigrants as much as citizens, often more intensely. The promise of upward mobility collides with an economy that increasingly rewards capital and credentials while limiting mobility for those without inherited advantage. When progress slows, disappointment is frequently internalized rather than attributed to structural constraints that were never clearly articulated. For refugees and asylum seekers, the contradiction is sharper. They are welcomed under humanitarian language that emphasizes protection and moral responsibility, yet they encounter underfunded support systems and extended periods of uncertainty. Safety is offered in principle, but stability arrives slowly. The country extends refuge without always providing a clear path toward integration, leaving people suspended between protection and permanence. For those without legal authorization, the experience is defined by fluctuation. Periods of relative stability alternate with moments of fear as enforcement priorities shift. Lives are built in the margins, sustained by work that is necessary, but often invisible. The path to legitimacy remains narrow or non-existent, even as contribution continues. This creates a population that is essential to the economy, yet excluded from the full protections of the system it supports. What unites these experiences is not chaos, but imbalance. Immigrants are asked to invest time, labor, and faith in a system that offers opportunity in theory while delivering it unevenly in practice. The gap between participation and belonging becomes a defining feature of the experience, shaping how people relate to institutions long after their legal status changes, if it ever does. This imbalance also affects how immigrants are positioned in public debate. They are often treated as beneficiaries of expansion or as sources of strain, rather than as individuals navigating constraints they did not design. Frustration that originates in system capacity is redirected toward people because systems feel abstract and unaccountable. Immigrants absorb tension that belongs to policy choices made far above them. Over time, this shapes civic behavior. Engagement becomes cautious. Trust is conditional. Participation is delayed until status feels secure, reinforcing broader patterns of disengagement across society. People focus on stability first because instability carries higher stakes. Public life becomes something to navigate carefully rather than something to shape openly. This is why immigrants are not drivers of disorder in this transition, but participants in it. They experience the same misalignment between promise and capacity that citizens do, only with fewer buffers and higher risk. Both groups are responding to a system that expanded its moral language without fully aligning its structure to support it. The strain created by demographic transition does not announce itself through collapse. It shows up through accumulation. Institutions continue to function, but with less margin, less flexibility, and less public trust. The stress is absorbed quietly by systems that were not designed for constant expansion without coordinated planning or sustained investment. Local institutions feel this first. School districts adjust to changing enrollment patterns, language needs, and resource demands while operating within budgets set years earlier. Housing markets tighten as population growth outpaces construction, driving costs upward without a single decision point to blame. Healthcare systems absorb greater demand while navigating staffing shortages, funding constraints, and regulatory complexity. None of these pressures are new on their own, but together, they create a sense that systems are always behind, always reacting, and rarely catching up. What makes this especially difficult is the way responsibility is distributed. Federal policy sets broad direction and moral tone. States manage implementation within political and fiscal limits. Local governments handle delivery on the ground. When strain appears, there is no clear owner of the outcome. Each level can point upward or outward. Accountability diffuses, even as consequences concentrate locally. This diffusion shapes public perception. People experience strain where they live, not where policy is written. They see crowded classrooms, rising rents, longer wait times, and stretched services. When explanations arrive, they are often technical, abstract, or delayed. Systems respond with process language, budget references, and jurisdictional boundaries that make sense internally but feel evasive externally. In that gap between experience and explanation, frustration grows. When people cannot see how decisions connect to outcomes, they stop believing that engagement will produce change. Institutions appear distant, even when they are working at capacity. Trust erodes not because systems fail outright, but because they fail to explain themselves in ways that feel grounded in lived reality. This is where enforcement begins to look appealing. Restriction offers a visible lever. It suggests action. It implies control. When long-term planning feels inaccessible and systemic reform feels impossible, limiting intake feels like a practical response, even if it does not address underlying constraints. Enforcement becomes a substitute for coordination. At the same time, institutions adapt to pressure by narrowing focus. Messaging becomes safer. Language becomes more generalized. Trade-offs are avoided in favor of reassurance. Policies are framed as necessary rather than chosen. Over time, this reduces transparency. People sense that decisions are being managed rather than discussed, which deepens disengagement. The result is a public sector that continues to operate, but with diminishing legitimacy. Compliance remains. Participation declines. People follow rules, pay taxes, and navigate systems without expecting responsiveness in return. Civic life becomes transactional rather than collaborative. This institutional thinning reinforces the broader dynamic. When systems do not feel accountable, people redirect frustration toward visible groups rather than abstract structures. Immigration becomes a symbol for overload because it is easier to point to than decades of fragmented planning and political avoidance. Institutions absorb pressure quietly while people argue loudly around them. What is happening here is not institutional failure in the dramatic sense. It is institutional exhaustion. Systems built for stability are asked to manage transition without being redesigned for it. They stretch, they adapt, they continue, but they do so without resolving the tension between promise and capacity that created the strain in the first place. This quiet strain matters because it shapes how the future is approached. When institutions feel brittle, societies become risk-averse. They favor restriction over expansion, control over openness, and reassurance over honesty. Policy becomes reactive rather than strategic, shaped by pressure rather than planning. Understanding this institutional dimension is essential because it explains why debates about immigration so often feel disconnected from outcomes. The system is not breaking in one place. It is thinning everywhere. And when thinning is mistaken for failure, the response is often to harden boundaries rather than strengthen structure. What remains is to ask what happens if this pattern continues and whether a society can navigate demographic transition without either denying it or panicking in response to it. What this entire sequence points to is not an immigration crisis in the narrow sense, but a power transition that has never been spoken about honestly. Immigration is the surface where that transition becomes visible, but it is not the source of the discomfort. The deeper issue is how a country built around demographic dominance adapts when that dominance begins to fade. Demographic change is not optional. It is driven by birth rates, global population distribution, education levels, and mobility. No policy can reverse those forces in the long term. Restrictions may slow certain flows temporarily, but they do not restore earlier demographic conditions. What they do instead is offer psychological reassurance the sense that control is being reasserted, even if the underlying trajectory remains unchanged. When reassurance substitutes for planning, policy becomes reactive. Decisions are made to quiet anxiety rather than to prepare systems. Short-term actions replace long-term coordination. Enforcement becomes more visible than investment. The appearance of control takes priority over structural alignment. This is how panic shapes policy. It does not announce itself as fear. It appears as urgency. It justifies speed. It narrows the range of acceptable conversation. Questions about capacity become questions about exclusion. Questions about planning become questions about permission. The focus shifts from how to adapt to who to stop. The danger of this approach is not immediate collapse. It is accumulation. Each reactive decision adds another layer without resolving the underlying mismatch between promise and capacity. Systems remain strained. Institutions continue to thin. Public trust continues to erode quietly. The cycle repeats with higher intensity each time. Avoidance plays a central role in this process. Avoidance of demographic reality. Avoidance of honest language about limits. Avoidance of acknowledging that equality and dominance are not the same thing, and that losing one does not mean losing the other. When those conversations are avoided, frustration looks for other outlets. History suggests that societies facing demographic transition have two broad paths. One path involves adaptation, investment, and honest communication about trade-offs. That path is slower, politically riskier, and less emotionally satisfying in the short term. The other path involves hardening, restriction, and symbolic gestures of control. That path feels decisive, but it rarely stabilizes the system it is meant to protect. Hardened systems do not stop change. They concentrate its pressure. Over time, that pressure finds release through institutional fracture, political volatility, or social unrest. The attempt to preserve dominance often accelerates the instability it was meant to prevent. What is missing in the current moment is not data or analysis. It is language that acknowledges reality without inflaming fear. A way to say that demographic transition is happening, that it will continue, and that it does not require panic or denial to navigate. Without that language, people default to narratives that promise restoration even when restoration is not possible. If this trajectory continues, disengagement will deepen. Citizens will continue to feel that participation does not translate into influence. Immigrants will continue to invest effort into systems that delay belonging. Institutions will continue to manage strain through process rather than reform. Public debate will grow louder while becoming less connected to outcomes. None of this requires bad intent. It only requires hesitation. Hesitation to name power. Hesitation to admit limits. Hesitation to align moral language with material reality. In that space, perception becomes easier to manage than structure, and policy becomes a tool for reassurance rather than preparation. The real choice facing the country is not between openness and restriction. It is between adaptation and denial, between planning for the society that is emerging or clinging to the one that no longer exists. Demographic change will continue regardless. The question is whether institutions and language evolve with it or resist until the strain becomes unavoidable. What history shows is that power can adjust or it can harden. Adjustment requires honesty. Hardening feels safer, but it carries consequences that surface later and more violently. The panic of transition does not disappear on its own. It either gets addressed deliberately or it reshapes the system through pressure. That is the ripple effect at work. One story, one truth, one ripple at a time. This is the ripple effect, powered by the Truth Project.